All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Bruce Castle presiding. All who have business before this court draw near and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. You may be seated.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Chief Judge Castle. To my right is Judge Davis. To my left is Judge Scholin. We're here today in the matter of Marguerite Castellano has a docket number of 093386. Would counsel for the parties please note your appearance for the record?
Norton Cutler for the appellant.
Thank you.
Mark Fitchich appearing on behalf of the Secretary. I'm accompanied today by Carolyn Washington, Deputy Assistant General Counsel of the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Thank you. Are both parties ready to proceed? All right. Each party will have 30 minutes to present argument. Counsel for the appellant, do you wish to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
10 minutes.
You have it, and you may proceed.
Good morning. My name is Norton Cutler, and I represent the appellant, Marguerite Castellano. This is a simple case which raises two issues. The first issue is, did the board properly refuse on the third occasion when the case went to the board to consider Dr. Nora's 2000 report that's found in the record at page 331? If the board improperly failed to consider that report, the report establishes beyond any doubt that Fred Castellano was 100% disabled because his service-connected anxiety either was misdiagnosed as bipolar or had developed into Alzheimer's.
Mr. Cutler, does Bell against Derwinski control here?
That is certainly a relevant case, Your Honor.
Okay. So does it control or not?
Yes, Your Honor.
It does. And what do you make of the changes to the VA's M21 manual?
We do not think those changes altered the fact that the 2000 report should be deemed to be in the record.
Because, go ahead.
If you look at 38 CFR 31000D4, that says evidence in the file at date of death.
You want to give me a minute to get there?
Oh, I'm sorry. That says that, and I quote, evidence in the file at date of death means evidence in VA's possession on or before the date of the beneficiary's death. And I believe that's where the quote in the Secretary's brief cuts off. But the rest of it says, even if such evidence was not physically located in the VA claims folder or on or before the date of death in support of a claim for VA benefits pending on the date of death. Here, Dr. Nora's opinion was clearly in Dr. Nora's mind, even if we're going to fight about when it came about. At the time, on May 18th, when Fred Castellano died, Dr. Nora already had this opinion. Just because it was written up on June 26th, well after, 1 month after Mr. Castellano died, doesn't mean that she didn't have that opinion on May 18th, and there was a pending case then.
And that's based on... She had that opinion on May 18th based on what exactly?
I think it's obvious from the document. Plus, she had examined Mr. Castellano and written another opinion in April of 1999. And I think she had regularly seen Mr. Castellano, it appears, from reading, the June 26th
document. When you
document.
Say it's obvious from the document, are you suggesting that the dates that are referenced in the document make her opinion that she had in her mind obvious? It's not obvious to me.
The document appears on its face to be a write-up.
It's dated June 26, 2000.
Yes, Your Honor.
So if you don't mind telling me what is so obvious that she had this in her mind on May...
Because she gave a very similar opinion in April of 1999.
Okay, that's helpful, Counselor.
And indeed, in a separate proceeding, the VA found that the two opinions were indeed very similar.
So whether or not this was written or committed to paper later, you're suggesting that this should have been in the record.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And if it is in the record, it needs to be considered by the board, right?
Yes, sir.
Which it was not. Is that your position?
That is our position.
Okay. Was the June 2000 report authorized by the VA, as far as you know or can tell from the record?
Certainly seems to be that way, Your Honor. Again, I guess we could find out some of these things by asking Dr. Nora. The reason why we never did that was because we thought that after writing the motion for remand, the board was actually going to consider it.
Okay, so if it's authorized by the VA, then this report would come in under the M21 anyway. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Now, just to play devil's advocate, if the report was not authorized by VA, in fact, instead, Dr. Nora was acting in her private capacity in doing that examination. Would it still come under the 2000 version of the M21-1 or the current version? Or
again, we think it comes under the CFR, which certainly overrides the M21.
Can you show me the language in the regulation that discusses evidence not yet created as opposed to evidence not yet in the file?
Again, we are relying on 3001D4, which I just read.
It says was not physically located in the folder. Doesn't talk about was not yet in existence.
Again, we contend that the opinion was in existence in Dr. Nora's mind, and she's certainly a VA employee.
So just sort of playing with the facts a little bit, because we'd have to determine if this applied to other circumstances. You said Dr. Nora had examined the veteran. Let's say she hadn't seen him since she'd written the 1999 report. Would there still be a report contemplated in her mind?
Certainly, because we contend that she was asked prior to the date of death to prepare this report.
So it's the request date that is significant?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you have any evidence that demonstrates when the request was made?
There's no specific evidence, but the case that this involved was pending since 1996. It was denied in 1996. It was appealed to the board in 1998, and it was sent back. Dr. Nora wrote her first opinion in 1999, which is similar to the second opinion, and then there was an ongoing proceeding in 2000. The file was reopened, and that's when they went to Dr. Nora.
Who would you argue has the burden of showing when the exam was requested?
Given that there's a pending case, and the document seems to indicate that the exam was requested for the pending case, and it would make no sense to request the file report without a pending case. It would appear that from the face of the document that it was requested prior to May 18th. Therefore, I think the burden is on the secretary to show otherwise.
So you believe you've met your burden to show that it is, and now the secretary would have to sort of rebut that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And I think the board engaged in speculation when it found otherwise.
Counselor, what is your position with respect to changes made to the M21? Do they need to go through a notice and comment process?
Yes, they should, Your Honor, but I think, and I'm sorry to repeat myself, but regardless, we're not relying upon the M21.
I understand that. I'm curious to your answer to the question.
Yes, it should go through a notice and comment process.
And do you understand that this change in 2000 did or did not go through a notice and comment process?
It's my understanding that it did not.
Okay. Thank you.
So back to the June 26, 2000 document. If a request is presented to a VA employee doctor for an opinion before the death of an individual, it's your position that whatever document is produced at any time thereafter is part of the file?
Yes, Your Honor.
Regardless of when the doctor may have formed an opinion?
The opinion should be formed prior to the death.
The opinion should be formed prior to the death. So
yes,
the June 26th document, the basis upon which you're saying it was formed prior to death, is because it's similar to the April 9th.
And the fact that we...
What does it add beyond the April 9th? Why is it relevant then? Why is it not cumulative?
Because it is somewhat plainer about the interrelationship between the anxiety disorder, the bipolar, and the dementia.
And because a request was made, in your opinion, before the date of the death, somehow or another, it's your view that the doctor must have had an opinion formed based on that request?
Yes, Your Honor.
Even though now it's different than the one from April 9th?
It's slightly different, but it's certainly plainer.
And if I look at this document, it indicates that it was at the request of the representative and the patient's wife.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is your client the patient's wife?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did she ask for this?
Yes, she did.
She personally called this doctor and asked him?
It is my understanding. I'm not,
did
I
you ask your
the
client?
Case below. I have not asked her that precise question. I've spoken to the people who handled the case below.
So do you think the Veterans Service Representative also asked?
Yes, Your Honor.
Have you asked the Veterans Service Representative?
I was told that by the person who handled the case below.
The person who handled the case below told you that the Veterans Service Representative specifically asked?
Yes.
Did that same person who represented this person below say that the patient's wife also specifically asked this doctor?
Again, I don't recall asking that.
You don't recall that. As far as the Veterans Service Representative, when I read this document, it does appear as though the doctor thought that the veteran was alive. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's the way I understand it.
And it's my understanding that the 15 June of 2000, the representative for the veteran at record 2032 presented a brief to the board. Have you looked at that?
I have read that brief, Your Honor.
And does it appear as though the veteran's representative thought that the veteran was alive as of that date?
May I have a second to, get to that page? You said 2031, Your Honor?
2032.
2032, thank you. Decided to move to another track.
That's okay. It's your time. But it's my question.
We're only too delighted to answer questions. You
I knew that. I just wanted to make it clear it was my question. Your time.
I think we'll have plenty of time. This is the crux of the case. Talking about the veteran in the present tense, so one would
correct.
Presume.
So it would appear as though the veteran's representative, who spoke to the doctor, was not aware as of the 15th of June that the veteran had deceased, and that's not all that unusual, is it?
I'm not experienced enough in this field to say that, but I think that is certainly possible.
So, okay, thank you.
I'd like to return to something you said earlier, please. You said that you had anticipated that on remand, the board would have asked Dr. Nora when the exam was requested.
No.
I'm sorry, did you not say that?
I was going to explain what I said, but
please, go ahead.
I think what I was trying to say is the reason why we didn't actually go try to get something from Dr. Nora and reintroduce it, which I'm not sure we could have anyway, but but was because we presumed they were going to look at it the way the remand motion was indeed written.
Okay, I'm sorry, I misunderstood. If VA had the opportunity, or you had the opportunity to go request Dr. Nora, do you have any insights into under what authority that new information from Dr. Nora about when the report was written could be brought into the record?
Here's my problem. This case has been bouncing around for a long time, so I would really like this court to make some kind of a decision because it goes up and down all the time. However, it does seem to me that if we're going to get new evidence, we probably have to go all the way back to the secretary. Because I'm not an expert in VA procedure, but I would assume that's the only way you can introduce the evidence.
Right, right. But even so, if it's below, since this is an accrued benefits case and we're limited to the record that was developed generally at the time of the veteran's death, would such a clarification be admissible?
I would hope so. Again, otherwise, I think what the document says on its face, appears to say on its face, is that the veteran was alive when they requested this. Otherwise, I don't see any point in doing it.
Well, what if they thought the veteran was alive? What if the Veterans Service representative called up the doctor and asked them to prepare this report, consistent with the report he was submitting on the 15th of June, thinking that the veteran was still alive, thinking he was processing his case, and he asked the doctor to prepare this statement?
Presumably
it could be that also, though, right? I mean, this is written as though the person thought the veteran was alive.
For the veteran service representative, but presumably Ms. Castellano knew whether or not her husband was alive.
Correct, but you don't know if she personally made a call or not, from what you said before.
Again, that is my understanding, but I have never asked her the question.
I'd like to clarify something. Does it matter if this request, I mean, this was done by an employee of the VA, and I got the impression that your position was that if an employee of the VA has an opinion in their mind, that is somehow of record?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. So accept that just for discussion purposes. It doesn't matter if the request was an official request by the regional office or a request by the veteran, does it?
No, Your Honor.
All right.
And really, it doesn't matter necessarily when it was made. Although I agree with you that there are some timing issues if given what we are indeed asking for. So I've kind of written out that.
Well, let me just follow up on that.
Sure.
So a doctor wrote an opinion a month before death. And after death, 2 months later, people are trying to file a claim for benefits, et cetera. They think about the accrued benefits claim. It's your view that you could go back to the doctor and say, can you clarify that opinion?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and what is that based on?
Let me try to I've tried to write this out so we can precisely get to what we're asking for. This court can find that where the opinion of an expert VA employee was clearly in the mind of the VA employee at the time of death, that opinion can be written down and used as evidence in the file after death. Now, I think the precedent...
And where are you getting that? Yeah, where are you getting that?
Again, I think the precedents which we cited, which I think are things like Hayes, do permit that. And I think
where does Hayes permit that?
I would say, I'm trying to interpret the star and pagination here for a second. Page 23. That's impossible.
Yeah.
I misread my star.
Around 360, maybe?
That, yes.
All right, why don't you read which section you're looking at? I'm trying to figure this out.
Yeah, section 6.
So, okay. Which paragraph in particular are you talking about? In addition, VA Manual M21-1, towards the end, states in relevant part that the cited regulations also provide for acceptance of evidence after death?
Yes.
So they're referring to regulations as providing it?
I agree with that.
All right, so the M21 isn't establishing anything. It's simply laying out what they think the regulations say.
That is certainly the way we interpret the M21.
Now, that regulation that they were based on was 1992?
Yes, Your Honor.
That regulation was changed, was it not?
And again, we think under the current regulation that it's still permitted.
Okay, so you're relying specifically under the current regulation, claims folder on or before the date of death in support of a claim of VA benefits pending on the date of death. And it doesn't have to be a document. It can be in somebody's mind.
As long as it's written down within some reasonable period after that.
Why does it have to be a reasonable period after?
Because if it's 1 year later.
Or so a reasonable period for you is 1 year?
No. I just think in this case, when it was less 40 days afterwards, okay. That's a reasonable period. I'm not asking you to set
no,
a complete
I'd limit
rule.
It to this case, too, because
yes.
It's a shorter period.
Exactly. This case, on its facts, has a lot of equity in it. Dr.
Well, Moore? I mean, go to the equity. Again, you've indicated that it's a similar statement to the one previously presented. What does it offer beyond what was previously presented?
I'm down to 16 seconds. May I answer this question?
Yes, you may.
Within 16 seconds.
No. Add 2 minutes, please. Three give you. I don't think there's an issue that he had mentioned Alzheimer's, is there?
I think that's the way she connects it up.
What does she connect?
The next paragraph is where she connects.
So four. Up. Paragraph four.
Yes.
So, and the connection is?
That she's saying that the anxiety was that the bipolar probably started with the anxiety. It's hard to tell. I think there's a lot of discussion in the briefs, too, which says that bipolar wasn't really a diagnosis back in 1994.
Well, that's another question I'll ask. You can intertwine both of them, and I'll add another 2 minutes to this because I want to hear your answer. Let's say they determined that it was a bipolar disorder, not just a general anxiety disorder. What symptoms were not considered by the rating official when they were providing a rating in this case?
I do not pretend to be a psychiatrist, but the way I understand all the opinions that have been written here is bipolar just didn't exist in 1944.
I
called it anxiety.
But the symptoms existed.
Yes.
So it was no anxiety reclassification.
That's what I'm trying to understand. So I read your brief, and I understand, oh, my gosh, it's bipolar. Let's assume it's bipolar. What's the difference? You still get rated the same way, don't you?
There's no question from looking at the documents but that his bipolar raised him to 100%. I think the secretary.
What symptoms of bipolar? What symptoms were not evaluated by the rating official?
I think the are you asking back in 1944?
Anytime in the record, I'm trying to figure out. If you have something called an anxiety or something called a bipolar, you're being rated on your symptoms. You're being rated on the impact.
My understanding is what the secretary's position is and the board's position is that. The anxiety was service-connected, okay? That got him to 50%. The bipolar was not service-connected, therefore...
But the bipolar wouldn't get him any more than 50% because it's the same symptoms.
Everybody agrees that he's 100% disabled, and there are about five opinions in the file saying that the bipolar is indeed causing it. And it's definitely...
Show me the five opinions in the record.
We have first Dr. Nora's opinion in 2000.
Well, because it had progressive long-term chronic problems of bipolar disorder, which led to global impairments?
Yes, Your Honor.
Exasperated and aggravated by the onset of Alzheimer's dementia?
Yes, Your Honor.
With no rating breakdown on what the impairments were, et cetera.
But
again, global impairments, we don't know exactly to the degree or anything.
I think based on Dr. Nora and some of these others...
All right, well, that's one. Go to the other.
You can't separate it. Okay, Ron Zedek, M.D., which is found at 2044.
Let me see if I have that just a second.
Okay.
All right, what does that one say? It probably had bipolar disorder.
And it needs to...
Bit of mood lability, effective instability and mood swings. Where does that say he's 100% disabled?
It says, in any case, Mr. Redcast is currently quite demented and really needs 24-hour daycare 7 days a week based
on... Okay, but dementia is something different, isn't it?
I think they're related.
Well, I thought the doctor said they weren't. I mean, bipolar and anxiety, I understand your argument. I'm trying to figure out what symptoms of bipolar or anxiety were not considered. I think you're saying bipolar and dementia and Alzheimer's are connected, and I don't see that connection.
I think
that... In fact, there's a VA opinion that's very strong against that.
There is definitely the VA going the other way. Those two VA doctors go the other way.
Okay, Larry, let's move on. Your second major order, you said the first one was that they properly refused to consider the report, Dr. Nora's report. What's your second issue?
Even without Dr. Nora's report, the decision it was arbitrary and capricious.
All right, and we're out of time. Does anybody, Judge, want to ask a additional question now? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court. Again, I'm Mark Vichich, appearing today on behalf of the Secretary. The appellant is seeking reversal in this case. However, the Board, at the very minimum, had a plausible basis in the record for its decision, and affirmance, not reversal, is the appropriate remedy. Appellant first attempts to package this case as a Board noncompliance with a court order granting the parties joint motion for remand. However, the Board satisfied the only clear and specific instruction provided to it when it issued this decision, which is currently on appeal. The only error identified in the joint motion was that the Board was to consider the possibility that the June 26, 2000 case review may have been constructively of record 5 weeks earlier on the date the veteran died.
What? Say that one more time. The only what?
The only specific instruction provided to the Board.
And who cares?
Excuse me?
Who cares?
Well, it matters because...
You have a joint motion for remand. The two parties agree that there's at least one error, and they agree to a remand. Does that in any way, shape, or form limit the Board?
No, Your Honor.
No.
But
so all other issues are open and available?
That's correct. However, but this Court held in Vogan v. Shinseki that the Board doesn't fail to comply with the terms of a joint motion unless it fails to follow clear and specific instructions provided in that document.
Okay, let us assume that the JMR didn't contain any additional instructions. Didn't the appellant submit additional arguments regarding TDIU, special monthly comp, that the Board did not address?
The Board, it did not specifically cite to that document. However, its decision addresses the arguments raised therein. For example, the bipolar, I believe it was the bipolar disorder argument was based on the June 26, 2000 case review, but the Board had already explained in approximately three pages that it could not consider that report for accrued benefits purposes. She also argued to the Board that the service-connected anxiety disorder had aggravated the dementia and that dementia should be granted service connection on that basis. However, at page 16 of the Board's decision, the Board specifically states the argument being advanced here is that the anxiety disorder aggravated the dementia. Then the Board explained from pages 16 through 21 of the record why it rejected that theory of entitlement. Regarding the special monthly compensation and the total disability rating issues, she had argued directly to the Board that the only evidence on the employability issue showed that the veteran was unable to work because of his anxiety diagnosis. However, at page 24 of the record, the Board specifically addressed this and rejected that when it relied on a December 1999 VA case review, which was signed by a VA psychologist and a VA neurologist. So although the Board didn't specifically cite to that document, the arguments therein were at least implicitly addressed throughout the Board's decision.
With regard to that last argument, the TDIU, the 99 report said that the veteran service-connected anxiety disorder contributed no more than 50% of his overall functional deficit. But it didn't say that half of his functional deficit was not insufficient to cause unemployability.
Well, I believe that, you know, by stating that no more than 50% of his functional deficit I believe it's a reasonable interpretation the board made that that meant that no more than 50% of what causes his problems, even if that results in unemployability, that it's not fully attributable.
So if we had a veteran who had Alzheimer's and we had a veteran who was a quadriplegic, independently those two different conditions couldn't cause him to be unemployable, even though each only contributed 50% of the unemployability?
If each only contributed 50% to unemployability...
No, to his total unemployability. But he was unemployable individually because of each condition. I just don't find this report as clear as either you or the board seem to think it is. But.
Okay. Well, the secretary would disagree and argue that that report was rather thorough and probative and gave the board at the bare minimum a plausible basis to conclude that the service-connected anxiety disorder alone was not contributing to his unemployability.
Thank you. I appreciate that. But rather than talk about the facts, I have many questions to do about the regulations and the M21-1 and the procedures. I think we should better spend our time there. The board decision cites to the new regulation, but it applies the M21-1.
Correct? Yes, correct.
And at this court, you argued that the 2000 M21-1 was the applicable law.
That's correct, yes.
So is it the Secretary's position then that the 2002 regulation change was not intended to have a retroactive effect to claims that were pending prior to that time?
No, either the regulation as it went into effect in 2002, I guess either version could apply, whichever would be most favorable, if we're talking about 3.1000D4. However, under neither the old regulation nor the new regulation, would this report, based on the factual findings by the board, would this report be considered in the file at death?
Well, let us assume that the board's factual findings were not accurate, just for the sake of discussion. I'm like to get back to what you're saying. So you're saying that either 3.1000 from prior to 2002 or post-2002 would apply?
The report was not in the file under either version of the regulation.
Okay. So is the fact that the Secretary didn't argue that the new regulation in its briefs or imply it in its board decision should apply evidence of intent that it was not intended to be retroactive?
No, Your Honor. The Secretary is not arguing that is not... It applies only because this case has been pending. It was pending as of 2002.
Okay. Let me back up. We start with the 1992 M21-1 manual provisions, correct?
Yes.
And Hayes found them to be substantive rules.
Yes.
And then in 2000, the VA promulgated new M21-1.
Correct, yes.
However, they did not issue those by notice and comment.
I'm not aware of that.
So a substantive rule would have to be replaced or revoked through the APA notice and comment procedures, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
So that would make the 2000 M21-1 provisions invalid?
I don't agree. I think that the M21 manual was an interpretation of 3.1000D4, which in response to the court's decision in Hayes, which called it confusing, the VA's interpretation of that regulation.
But again, if it's changing the interpretation that the court found substantive because the regulation wasn't sufficient, the regulation wasn't changed until after the M21 provision. So how could the M21 provision in 2000 have any force and effect?
The Secretary does not have a position on that.
Mr. Vichich, was Dr. Nora's June 26, 2000 report authorized by the VA?
Well, it was. She's a VA psychologist, so I don't think the authorization is an important distinction. I think because it was created by a VA psychologist, it would implicitly be authorized by VA. But here the issue is when it was actually created and prepared. And here, because it was dated June 26, 2000, and the board plausibly concluded that it was not requested until after the veteran's death, that it gave the board a plausible basis to find that it was not in the file as of May 18th. And appellant's argument that just because it was in her mind at the date of death is not supported by the statute. The statute 5121 draws a line at evidence in the file at death.
Do you know when the report was requested?
It is not clear. It appears, based on the June 15th, 2000 argument to the board, that it had not been requested yet. At least that's what the board had found, and that's plausible because the representative would not have argued to the board, please issue a decision now if the submission of additional evidence was pending. So the board plausibly concluded that after that argument was submitted, then it went and perhaps discussed with the appellant and said, hey, let's get a report, or maybe she went directly to the doctor. It's not clear, but in any event, it's, you know, the date of the report itself is at least gave the board a plausible basis to find that it was not in the record 5 weeks earlier. And again, the statute draws the line and holding that, you know, a doctor can prepare a report, you know, 5 weeks or 1 year after death based on what was in her mind could essentially open up the development of an entire accrued benefits case based on evidence that really wasn't created until after death, and that's not contemplated by the statute.
It seemed to be contemplated by the M2001 back in 1992, though.
The VA's interpretation of that was, as this court stated in Hayes, confusing. There was not clear as to what post-death evidence. The regulation specifically referred to the death certificate, and in Hayes, this court stated that the regulation applied only to the death certificate and evidence in the file, and VA's practice was lacked clarity.
It was broader than the regulation.
It was arguably broader than what was included in the regulation. But again, those were not in effect during this case.
If VA, or if there is a question of fact as to when the report was requested, does VA have an obligation to go back and ask under Savage or one of these other more recent cases?
The Secretary does not believe so, Your Honor, simply because this is an accrued benefits claim, which that's what distinguishes this claim from, say, Savage or a regular service connection claim, and that is because the statute draws that bright line between what is to be considered it for the purposes of this type of claim, and any clarification or development of evidence is essentially creating new evidence or altering existing evidence, and that's not contemplated by 5121. Additionally, the appellant raised an argument in her brief regarding nursing home records. These were from a private nursing home. Approximately 1,500 pages of records were received about a year after the veteran's death. Even if these are deemed in the file at death, she hasn't explained how they are at all relevant. So even if the board ignored them, there would be no error unless they were relevant and favorable to the claim. But she has not met a burden of demonstrating prejudice with respect to those records. Regarding the Alzheimer's disease and bipolar disorder, these, again, are just disagreements with how the board weighed the evidence and made its ultimate factual findings. She doesn't identify any evidence that the board failed to consider or any regulation the board misapplied. Instead, she just disagrees with how the board weighed the evidence. And with respect to the Alzheimer's disease, the only evidence that bared on that issue was speculative in nature, stating, well, the Alzheimer's could or may have been aggravated or related to the anxiety disorder. But this course has held repeatedly that benefits cannot be granted on speculative evidence. With respect to the bipolar disorder, the board did acknowledge that there were medical reports of record diagnosing bipolar disorder, but again, the board weighed that evidence against other evidence of record, and in particular the December 1999 VA case review, which had been signed by both a VA neurologist and a VA psychologist. And the board plausibly concluded that the veteran did not have bipolar disorder.
If I may interject and get back on my broken record, If this court were to apply the 2000 M21-1 provision or the 92 M21-1 provision, would we look to 3.1000 as written in prior to the change in 2002, or would we look to the current provision in trying to interpret it?
Well, the VA adjudication manuals from 2000 and 92 were interpreting the regulation as in effect prior to 2002. So that
it would be the corresponding in time.
Yes, exactly.
Thank you.
And the regulatory change, you know, the secretary explained the reasoning for deleting this portion of the VA adjudication manual in 2002 when it amended the regulation. Regarding the special monthly compensation issue and the total disability rating issue, Judge Scholin had raised a question earlier about the December 1999 case review and the 50% functional deficit. The secretary doesn't have much more to add other than what was in his brief, but just to reiterate the point that the arguments raised by appellant are essentially disagreements with the board's weighing of the evidence and factual findings. The board did cite to the relevant evidence of record and plausibly concluded that the evidence weighed against finding that entitlement to those benefits was warranted. Secretary will conclude by asking this court to affirm the board's decision.
May I have 1 minute to confer with a colleague over here prior to the rebuttal?
Sure.
What's your colleague's name in the record, please?
Christine, sorry, she changed her last name.
Hill.
Hill. She. Christine Hill. She's with the NVLSP.
Thank you.
And I will express my thanks to them for working with me yesterday.
Thank you.
I think it's clear from the court's questions that the court is well focused on the important issue here, so I don't want to take a lot of your time, but I just want to pose one hypothetical. Let us suppose that we can prove that Dr. Nora began the case review on May 17th. And for some reason, Dr. Nora is a busy person, makes notes, dictated whatever, takes a couple days to get all that transcribed, and the veteran dies on May 18th. If the report is dated May 20th, it would seem clear that it should have gone into the record.
Why?
Because at that point, all we have is a transcription issue. It is a ministerial issue which is covered by Hayes.
Transcription of what? The brain?
No, transcription of Dr. Nora's notes.
Well, the notes could go in, couldn't they? Is that what you're saying? What, they dictated notes? You would have a tape.
Yeah, like many doctors.
But we don't have a tape. We have a brain.
Again,
we can... So give me the example where you have a brain, where somebody has it in their head. I mean, it's not a transcription, because if it was a transcription, you could put the notes in the record, correct? They were prepared before date of death. They were within VA hands before date of death.
Suppose the notes were actually written out from her memory 2 days afterwards. I guess that's in the brain, yes.
Okay, well, that's the example then.
Okay.
So now why is that clear?
Again, I think for two or 3 days, we wouldn't have any doubt. We certainly
can't. I mean, if it was so clear, we wouldn't be a panel, would we?
Probably true. 2 or 3 days seems to me, without doubt, we wouldn't be here because the board would have already ruled in our favor. Now, why does June 26 make that much difference is indeed what we contend. Well, I certainly understand that if this report was dated May 18th, 2001,
people would be asking lots of questions and reasonable questions. All we're asking you to do is, on the facts of this case, find that Dr. Knorr's report should have been taken into the record. Now, we do contend that even if that report is excluded, the great weight of the evidence is that Mr. Castellano had service-connected bipolar and Alzheimer's. And I think I took you through three or four of the reports. The report on the other side isn't all that clear. I think it's found at page 2092, but let me get this.
Maybe 2096.
I think that's right. On page 2097, there's quite a bit of acknowledgement of the back and forth of opinions on the interconnection
of what?
Of Alzheimer's, bipolar, and anxiety.
And where's the interconnection between Alzheimer's and the other two?
I'm reading from on page 2098.
To what?
2098.
I have it.
There's a good deal of confusion expressed about whether the veteran's current problems are an extension of his service-connected anxiety disorder or whether they are due to an organic mental disorder. The diagnosis of an organic mental disorder, possibly Alzheimer's, is based on medical and neuropsychological findings. It is a separate diagnosis where collective symptomology does not overlap significantly.
So what's the comparison there?
Again, I'm just saying these doctors went through the various issues about whether they were interconnected, and I agree at the end they concluded they were not.
So why would it be unreasonable for the board to give greater weight to this?
Because these doctors had a lot of doubt about it, and I think Dr. Nora and the other four opinions...
And doesn't it have to rise to more than... I mean, doesn't it just have to be plausible? Doesn't
the
board just have to have a...
Again, we would contend that it wasn't plausible given all the other opinions versus this one.
But again, where do your, I mean, your other opinions seem to be indicate bipolar and so forth.
Certainly Dr. Nora doesn't.
Dr. Nora doesn't. But Dr. Nora also had an earlier one where she didn't even have bipolar. Is that not correct? the 96 or the earlier time period?
99?
No, the 99. There's one predating. Didn't the board reject these or give less weight because of the inconsistencies in the opinions?
Yes, which I totally don't understand why someone can't have a different opinion 3 years later.
Okay, they have a different opinion, but then they have other doctors that were more consistent with their earlier opinion. Do you understand that?
They have two doctors who say that in a fairly inconclusive fashion. And then I'll close by stating that if this court finds that there was 100% disability service connected, then TDIU and the SMAC should also be granted.
Do you have a problem with the board reissuing its statement with additional comment on new issues that were raised? It seems like you did in your brief, that you believe that meant they didn't review your arguments.
It certainly looked like they didn't.
But your arguments to the board were very similar to the arguments here in court.
Yes, but we did raise those other issues, and they didn't seem to do anything about them.
So it's not the objection of... What if they read them and said, my answer is still the same? What's wrong with them printing
them? Then we would
out?
At least know that they read them.
So if they had put a statement in there saying that they read them?
Or at least responded to our statement.
But isn't the board presumed to have reviewed all evidence before it?
We suppose so.
Isn't that the law?
We accept that. Again, our position is from reading the opinion, you sure couldn't tell that.
Thank you.
And I want to thank the court for its courtesy. I've argued in several courts of appeals, and this is clearly the most welcoming one I've ever been to. Thank you.
That the case will be submitted. We will come down and greet counsel.
All rise.
Thank you.
That's a very nice arcade.
Have a good trip. Colorado.